Well, thank you all for coming. My name is Brantley Womack, and I teach in the politics department here at University of Virginia. And thanks also to the Miller Center for sponsoring this series of talks that we're going to have this semester on China's rise in historical perspective. And I think this historical perspective is necessary for us for two reasons. For one, for most of us, China's rise is a pretty recent phenomenon. 10 years ago, would you have thought of China's rise? 20 years ago, would you have thought it possible? 40 years ago, the problem of the China threat was a very different kind of threat of communism and Mao Zedong and the Cultural Revolution. So for one thing, we have this new phenomenon. For another thing, we have a culture that most of us are not that familiar with. If we hear of the French doing something, we think, ah, the French. Now, we all know the French. We eat their fries, except in times of great hostility when they're turned into freedom fries. Okay, but with China, it's a big unknown, and it's a recent unknown. And that the recentness of our attention to China in this new form as large country, as large economy, as economy that with exposure to our own economy, means that we don't sense that much of a track record for it. And our unfamiliarity with Chinese culture means we find it very difficult to predict or very difficult to feel comfortable or confident where China might go next. So that question that becomes more important to us every day, and I think is even of greater importance in this new era of global economic uncertainty that's begun in the last year. What will China do next? Seems to be a question where practically any answer is possible. Where some people say China's going to fall apart, some people say China's going to become the big power challenge the United States, et cetera. But a good deal of this problem, of this uncertainty, or at least this disorientation of facing China, is due to our lack of familiarity with China. After all, China has been where it's been. China has a track record, thank you. It's one of the oldest civilizations in the world. It has its own sense of its history, and even though it also is facing new circumstances that require new thinking and will produce new policies, it won't be from zero. It won't be for lack of a background, for lack of a track record. It will be on the basis of China's experience. It will interpret the challenges it faces in terms of its own experience. And therefore, to understand where China is, we must take that perspective seriously. And that's what this series is about. What we hope to do in our 5 sessions over the course of this semester is cover China in terms of China's identity, both to itself and in the world, and that's our topic for today. To cover China in terms of security, again, historical as well as contemporary, sense of security and insecurity for China. How different is that from our own? How different is this from the Western and the European experience? Then we talk about China's economy. For many of us, this is the big question. And this also has a history. And the pre-reform era economy of China is important in order to understand what has been going on for the last 30 years in China. Then we will be talking about environment and resources. Our discussion of the environmental history of China will bring out how much China has been dealing with serious environmental problems almost since its beginning. Since its beginning, when elephants roamed as far north as Beijing, and now with the destruction of forest cover over the last 3,000 years, are now only on the Burmese border. Then we move on to politics and the political institutions of traditional China and to what extent those institutions supply a heritage for Chinese political reform and the parameters of China's political reform in the current era. So those are our 5 topics. Those are the things we'll be covering during this series. And we're getting off to a grand start today with two preeminent experts in their area. Lowell Dittmer is a political scientist at University of California, Berkeley. I'm sure I won't go into the details of his career, but he's famous person who is very, very well known for many, many aspects of China's domestic foreign policy as well as international policy. And Joe Escherich is a historian of China, also famous person. But that's only part of the reason they're here. Another part of the reason is they also represent the globalization of expertise on China. Both Joe and Lowell are constantly in an interaction with historians, political scientists, and political figures in China. The research there that many of Lowell's students, I know best since we're both political scientists, are leading figures in political science both in China and Taiwan. And so this interaction, that we're not just, what we have is not just outsiders that know more looking at China. We have outsiders who are interacting with China and can therefore present that perspective better. So not to waste any more time, let me turn the floor over to Joe Escherich, who will be talking about China's rise in historical perspective from the point of view of China's identity and how that has shifted. Joe.
Thanks very much, Brantley, and it's a real pleasure to be here. My first visit, really, to the University of Virginia and, of course, to the Miller Center here. And I really appreciate the introduction that Brantley has given to this series, because in many ways, if one tries to think of China's relation to the world from a Chinese perspective, one can almost think that China is once again resuming its rightful place in the world. Historically, historians would now look back and say China was, for most of its history and most of world history, the largest, most prosperous, best governed country in all of the world. It went then through a traumatic period, a century of humiliation at the hands of Western and Japanese imperialism. And now again, it is rising to the place that, to some degree, it thinks is the logical place in which it would be. And what I want to do today is to talk about this process very, very briefly, very schematically, in terms of three stages. And we begin in pre-modern China, when the foreign relations of China were shaped by what we call the tribute system. And the tribute system is a Western concept, but it's based on a reading of the codes and the records of the Chinese, of their relations with people in other parts of the world, that describe these relations as other countries coming to offer tribute to China as the Chinese emperor, as son of heaven, as the center of the universe, and as the supreme sovereign in a hierarchy of sovereigns throughout the world. Now, recent scholars have questioned the kind of Sinocentric, the Chinese-centric notions and the superiority of the Chinese in this conception of the tribute system. And in fact, in a couple of weeks, you're going to be hearing a talk by Evelyn Roski here, who's going to stress the degree to which the Chinese were a good deal more flexible in their actual relations with the outside world than was implied by this tribute system model. But I want to stress here, in a sense, the formal rigidity rather than the practical flexibility of this model and the implications of it. Now, I note three aspects of the tribute system model. One was that the Chinese emperor was the son of heaven, and he was therefore the supreme sovereign among sovereigns of the world in a hierarchically ordered system. And I think we have to understand and appreciate the extent to which the notion of hierarchy was almost instinctive, not only in China, indeed, but in most of the pre-modern world, where hierarchies of age and gender and status were taken for granted, much as the modern world takes equality of formal social relations and diplomatic relations as the norm under which we should operate. So in the pre-modern world, a hierarchy was very much assumed to be the model. And even in Chinese terms for family relations, there's a distinction between an older and a younger brother, or an uncle who is the older or younger brother of one's husband, or a grandfather who is on the paternal side as opposed to the maternal side. And these would all be ordered in a proper place in the ritual hierarchy. And so it was with foreign relations. Now, the second aspect of foreign relations is the notion that, in a sense, there is no foreign. There is a classic statement in the Book of Odes that is repeated in almost all of the ritual texts that discuss foreign relations, that there is no land within the four seas which does not belong to the emperor, and there is no one within the four seas who is not a subject of the emperor. This has been sort of subsumed into a Chinese notion of what they call wu wai, that there be no foreign, there no distinction between the domestic and the foreign, that it's all part of one ritual hierarchy, in which, of course, the Son of Heaven is one. And therefore, there's a kind of graded set of relations between the people closer to the center, who are more strictly and directly and legally controlled by the emperor and his bureaucracy, and somewhat more distant lands, which will offer regular tribute to the emperor, and for whom, as in the case of Korea and Vietnam, two of the clearest model, would actually accept the Chinese calendar as their own, which would have an examination system that would be modeled on the Chinese classics, who would write their official documents in the Chinese language, and who would accept their status as tributaries, offering regular tribute to the Chinese emperor. And more different, distant lands, who would come less frequently and would have a higher degree of autonomy. And then ultimately, at the end, there would be barbarians who would, to some degree, resist the attraction of the Chinese center. And the Chinese, and this is the third aspect of this view of the world, viewed these barbarians as perhaps reformable, but on the other hand, in a sense, almost sort of on the edge of the animal kingdom. And thus, the very terms for the northern barbarians, the di, contained a character for the dog, radical. And the western barbarians, the qiang, had the sheep, radical. And the southern barbarians, the man, had the insect, radical. These were people who were on the edge of humanity. If they came more frequently, they could perhaps be transformed, and they could be caused to learn the proper ritual forms, and in that sense be civilized, and in a sense then become Chinese. So there's a formal rigidity in this system, but there's a very practical adjustments to it in its relations with foreign relations. And I want to relate just one case of this, which was the relations between the Qing Empire, the last Chinese empire, and the Russians, which was, in a sense, the first time that it came in direct contact with another European empire on its northern border as the Russians expanded across Siberia and ultimately reached the Manchurian frontier on the Amur River in the 17th century. And as conflicts increased with the new Qing dynasty, which itself had just been established in 1644, the Qing were very concerned that this border region be pacified, that the relations with these new barbarians that had occurred, appeared to the north of them, be brought into some order. And so they attempted a number of different diplomatic relations and interactions between the Tsar and the Emperor. The Tsar also was anxious to establish contact with the Chinese, partly so they could enter the Chinese market and sell the furs that they were harvesting in Siberia. And all of these diplomatic contacts, were very problematic, as the Chinese were insisting on the Russians acknowledging the ritual superiority of the Chinese emperor, and the Tsar's representatives being unwilling to do so. But eventually, they reached a treaty, and one of the reasons they were able to do so is that they negotiated the treaty not in the Chinese capital, but in the border city of Nerchinsk. And therefore, it becomes the Treaty of Nerchinsk, negotiated in 1689. And it was the first treaty that the Chinese signed in early modern times, the first treaty with a European country, which was essentially on the basis of the European model of Westphalian equality between states. And so the Chinese, in a sense, abandoned this notion that they were superior, they were the center, and other people had to offer ritual obeisance to them. But there's an important qualifier here. The treaty was negotiated on the border, and the accounts of the treaty negotiation are quite frank in their secret communications with the emperor. But when the emperor finally signed the edicts, which would announce that the border with the Russians had been pacified, he announced that he had been indulgent of the ignorance of the Russians of proper diplomatic forms. And therefore, he had punished them in battle. There had been a few skirmishes. The Russians probably won as many as the Chinese had, but the Chinese announced that the Russians had been punished for their misconduct. And ultimately, the Russians had learned the lesson, and they had turned towards civilization and accepted the proper ritual forms, and therefore peace could be attained with the Russians. In other words, what the Chinese did in this more public announcement of the treaty was to insist that the old forms had been maintained, and that the emperor's ritual superiority had been maintained. They had been flexible in practice, but in all of the official record of this, they had maintained the degree of Chinese superiority. When, a century later, the British came and tried to negotiate at the end of the 18th century treaties of trade, and the most famous incident here was the Macartney mission to China, much studied, of 1793. There was endless controversy between the British and the Chinese representatives on the proper ritual forms for this mission, and in particular, whether Lord Macartney should be required to kowtow before the emperor, a kowtow being a very clear form of ritual obeisance in which he would be required to kneel three times and on each kneeling to prostrate himself three times. So the three kneelings and the nine prostrations which were required. And Macartney indicated that he was not going to do this, that he represented the sovereign. He was only going to kneel on one kneel as he would to his own sovereign. It went back and forth. To this day, we don't know what Macartney did. The Chinese insisted that he did do the three kneelings and the nine prostrations. Macartney insisted that he did not. It was partly possible to have this ambiguity because, again, this was not exactly in Beijing, but it was up in the summer palace in Chengdu, somewhat to the north. When, about 20 years later, the British came in 1816 and insisted again on negotiations to open trade in 1816 with Lord Amherst coming, then the interaction came in Beijing, then there was no compromise on each side, and then the whole mission broke down as an utter failure. Well, part two, the treaty system. The West comes and opens China with the Opium War, in part after a series of interactions such as this in which the British insist on diplomatic equality and the Chinese insisted on maintaining some form of the tribute system. And out of this, in the defeat of the Chinese, came what we call the treaty system and the century of treaties. And the irony here is that fundamental to these treaties was the Westphalian notion of diplomatic equality between two equal states. But the content of the treaties is what the Chinese have come to know as the unequal treaties. They were formally equal, but the Chinese were consistently disadvantaged and lost sovereignty through the course of these treaties. They fixed Chinese tariffs at very low levels. They gave the foreigners extraterritorial privileges in China. They offered colonial enclaves in major Chinese cities like Shanghai and Tianjin, which were under foreign control as foreign concession areas. Progressively, Chinese territory was lost in Hong Kong. Taiwan was lost to the Japanese. Korea and Vietnam became colonies of the French and the Japanese, respectively. And these foreign privileges consistently expanded under the treaty system. So that, for example, the tariff system was set at a very low level, and through a series of arrangements, it came to be agreed that the foreigners would actually collect the tariffs in an institution called the Imperial Maritime Customs, and then turn the revenues over to the Chinese government. Later, the Imperial Maritime Customs started collecting the salt revenues as well and running the post office. And when at the end of the dynasty, there was a question of who they would turn these revenues over to, the foreigners made the decision about which government they would recognize as the legitimate government and turn the revenues over to. And so when you get into the 1920s and Sun Yat-sen's revolutionary government establishes itself in a Canton in the south, they insisted that the customs revenues in the territory that they controlled be turned over to their government. And the foreigners said, no, we're going to turn them over to your enemies, the warlords in the north. And it was that loss of Chinese sovereignty that became so much of the bone of contention in Chinese nationalism in our Act III. Chinese nationalism rises above all against this, the unequal treaties and the loss of sovereignty in this century of Western and Japanese imperialism. And it sought above all to recover Chinese sovereignty, a process that was really only accomplished finally with the victory of Mao's revolution in 1949, when all of the treaty privileges that had fueled this nationalism were finally abolished. But nationalism had fueled the revolution that brought down the last empire in 1911. It had fueled Sun Yat-sen's revolution in the 1920s, and it fueled, especially in the opposition to Japanese imperialism, the Chinese Communist Revolution in the 1930s and 40s. And to a very large degree, the legitimacy of any Chinese regime has depended upon its ability to demonstrate its capacity to maintain and defend and protect the sovereignty of China. And what critics of the government have again and again criticized the government for, and in these revolutions overthrown a previous government for, has above all been the failure of the Chinese government on grounds of nationalism and protection of Chinese sovereignty. And so, in lessons for the present and some of this sort of great past and present of China, I would note that the legitimacy of any Chinese regime, whether it is a Chinese emperor who insists on the maintenance of the mandate of heaven, partly through the successful handling of barbarians and the barbarians recognizing him as the sovereign, or the legitimacy of the present Chinese government as the head of the Chinese nation and the defender of Chinese sovereignty. The domestic political legitimacy has always been intimately tied up with the successful carrying out of foreign policy. And in that sense, this notion of Wu Wai, that there is no foreign, there is no clear distinction between political legitimacy domestically and internationally, I think to some degree continues in China to this day. Thank you very much. Great.
Thank you very much, Joe. And now we move on to Lowell Dittmer and the People's Republic of China.
Thank you very much, Brantley. It's a great privilege and honor to be here, and I'd like to thank to Professor Womack and the Miller Center for sponsoring this forum. I think it should be very useful. As we've already learned, the Chinese feel that their rise is not only a recent phenomenon, but something that has been necessary and needful for a century at least. The Chinese have a teaching about the century of humiliation, basically from around 1842, the end of the Opium War, up until the 1940s, in which they were humiliated by Western imperialist powers. And they conceived of a need for national salvation, which is to rise from this position of humiliation, to regain the position of status and prestige in the world that they previously had, as they see it. And ever since Mao stood at the gate of Tiananmen and said that China has stood up, China has seen itself as rising, although it's only recently that we've had this perception in America and in the West that China is rising. But ever since 1949, it's been rising. And so I want to talk about several respects in which its rise has been consistent, several ways in which this has been consistent over these bewildering changes that we've seen in the last over 50 years. And then I want to talk about the different stages, four different stages in which this has changed, China's rise has changed. First, the ways it's been consistent. First, China has always seen its way of making foreign policy as having a moral content, more than we do. Most countries have interests, national interests, and so forth. China has principles, moral principles in its foreign affairs. And these foreign principles, you know, like the five principles of peaceful coexistence, some principles are generally applicable to all countries in the world. Some are more specifically oriented to specific bilateral relations, such as the three fundamental obstacles were problems with the Sino-Soviet relationship for many years. So they have principles that they establish that should be conformed to. So the principles are not only for their own regulation, but for the other side has to agree to these principles as well. And if the other side refuses to agree to these principles, the relationship is abnormal or not normal. It's not a normal relationship, and it has to be normalized. We have to work on normalizing our relationship because you don't understand the principles that they should use here. That's one way in which it's been consistent ever since 1949. Second, their conception of foreign policy has been that it has to conform to a theory of how the world is made up. So it's not just their own foreign policy that they're making up. They're making up something that fits into a conception, an integrated conception of the way the world operates. So they have like the three world system. This was under Mao, that there were three worlds. First world is, of course, the superpowers, he thought. This is a different way of looking at it, the superpowers, then the secondary powers, such as Europe, and then the third world, which is the developing countries. And today it's the harmonious world under Hu Jintao. This is a theoretical conception of the world that's more ambitious than purely national interest. And third, they've never practiced real imperialism as the other countries have who have risen. Typically, the European countries, Germany, Britain was the most famous imperialist country. The sun never set on the British Empire, had colonies over a fourth of the world, I think it was. And then France and Germany and their Nazi period was imperialist, of course. China's never really been imperialist in that same sense. I'm not trying to glorify them. I mean, they've had their troubles on the border. They've had a lot of war, a lot of border wars, even since 1949, starting with Korea. So they have not been peaceful all the time, but they've never been imperialist in the sense that they've tried to establish hegemony over culturally alien peoples and to try to that I know of. I mean, Professor Escherich can speak more to this. So these ways are in which China has been. These are three ways in which China has been consistent during this period. But certainly, China has evolved and made major changes in its policy since 1949. It's been so bewildering that when we study China, we keep changing our conceptual apparatus to study China because China, the China we study has changed so dramatically. As I see it, there are four basic sort of what the Chinese call lines. They call it a Lushan. There are policy lines that obtained for maybe around 10 years or so, and then when these break down, usually in a crisis of some sort, there's a pause, and during this pause period, there's greater latitude for different proposals. There may be several different lines going off experimentally in different directions, and there may be controversy in even the public media, different sorts of ideas being proposed at the same time. And then after this period of controversy, this pause, then either the elites get tired of this sort of give and take or else they come to a resolution, and then a new line is proposed. So it's a sort of path-dependent learning, if you will, in which the national interest certainly is primary. And a new line is proposed, and there's not learning for after that, because after that they establish a new authority around this new line, and they don't welcome negative feedback. So it's more of an implementation of this line until they reach another crisis. And so as I see it, there are four periods of during the since 49 period. The one is from 50 to 1960 about. The period of socialist construction, and the second period is from 66 to 76, the period of Cultural Revolution, great proletarian Cultural Revolution. The third period is the Deng Xiaoping period, from 1980 basically to 1989 or 90, or well 1992 I would say, the Deng Xiaoping period from 1980 to 1992. And the fourth is the post-Deng period. I don't know, it's really since 1992 to the present. And each of these periods had three dominant influences, I think. One is domestic policy, second is foreign policy, and third is political leadership. The political leadership tries to synthesize these two different streams into a coherent line. The first period was focused on socialist construction. That means the socialization of the means of production, as they called it in the domestic economy. There are two focuses. One was on socialization of the means of production. That means the socialist transition. They started with land reform, then mutual aid teams, then agricultural producers cooperatives, and then finally the communes in the agricultural sector. And in the cities, they nationalized the factories and the retail stores and so forth. And so everything was run on a plan. And the second sort of concern was, of course, to regenerate production, because they had gone through a huge disaster with the Civil War and the Japanese invasion and so forth, stabilized the currency, and launched the first five-year plan and so forth. And they seemed to be relatively successful during this first 10-year period. During the first five-year plan, the growth rate averaged about 8% per year. It was a tumultuous period because this, from campaign to campaign, first land reform, and then collectivization drives, and so a lot of mass movements and so forth. And so in retrospect, one looks back to it as a stable period, but really it was a lot of commotion. And relatively successful. There were two problems with the period, I think. One, in terms of foreign policy, the general sort of international picture was one of tight bipolarity between the Soviet bloc or communist bloc countries and the free world, as they called it. And this was, however, a loosening bipolarity, because by 1958, you had the Camp David spirit. Khrushchev came to America, and he made a tour of the United States. And there was an opening to détente between the two superpowers. And in this context, Chinese foreign policy went against the tide, in that it was increasingly diverging from the Soviet foreign policy, from the communist bloc policy. they saw their own interest more with the Third World, so they tended to align with the Third World. They radicalized their foreign policy, and they developed an increasing disagreement with the Soviet Union, the Soviet foreign policy. In all of these respects, Mao was just demonstrating his charismatic boldness and originality, seizing the leadership in the name of ideology, an ideology which he, to some extent, personally innovated. It was not an entirely rubber-stamped Marxist-Leninist. It was Mao Zedong thought. So bold, charismatic leadership, but it was risk-taking. But it was still, he could still get away with it. But there was a split within the leadership about domestic politics. The Great Leap Forward was, of course, one of the huge disasters of mankind, precipitating one of the greatest famines in history. 20 to 30 million Chinese died of starvation during the Great Leap Forward context. And this created a split within the elite that was only superficially resolved. And so from 1960, I would say, up until 1966, this was a period of a pause, as we say, in which there was unresolved tension within the elite, different ideas being proposed. In domestic politics, they had a revisionist policy. In foreign policy, it was more radical, Sino-Soviet dispute and so forth, and a radical third world policy. So tensions finally resolved by the Cultural Revolution, in which Mao seized power again in the name of radicalism. And for the next 10 years, China launched this great proletarian Cultural Revolution, which in its in retrospect is widely condemned today. But at the time, it was conceived as a bold and quite original, and it got a lot of worldwide support, established China's reputation as a bold innovator, willing to take major risks to assault the status quo and to attempt something original as a sort of exemplar of charismatic leadership. And the Cultural Revolution, however, was riddled with contradictions, not only the contradiction between economic productivity and radical egalitarianism. They had a Gini index of about 2.3, you know, Gini index, the lower it is, the more equal you are. So about 2.3, something like that. So one of the more equal societies, as far as we can tell. People would hide, if they had a TV set, that they would hide it and so forth. But apparently, as far as we can tell, really very equal. Cultural uniformity, cultural radicalism. Psychologically, you were to purify your heart and become concerned only about the collective interest and crush your individual selfishness. That was the whole psychological dimension of it. But it was just not sustainable. Not purely because of economic reasons. Economic production was not that bad. It was not a Great Leap Forward type of collapse. Probably economic growth averaged 5.56% during that period, which is not bad. It wasn't as good as either the previous period or the subsequent period of reform, but it was not bad in terms of world trends at the time. But two problems. One is that the ratio of accumulation to consumption was very high, a very high savings rate, and so you had no incremental growth in per capita incomes during that period, basically flat. So people didn't see any increase in their living standards during this Cultural Revolution period. And there was no innovation in terms of technical. I mean, they were falling behind technically. The factories were getting out of date. They were cut off from the world. That was the idea of that they completely cut themselves off from the world. If you connect with the world markets, you're subject to exploitation, and so that was the idea. So by the end of the, by the Mao's death, people were generally exhausted. They conceded that Mao was right ideologically and morally, but they were exhausted and it just couldn't go on, and that was just widely accepted, I think, at the time, although it was not admitted by the leadership that Mao chose, and not until Deng Xiaoping rose in 1978 at the Third Plenum of the 11th Party Congress did he openly accept this. He had been down to the countryside during his own punishment during the Cultural Revolution, and he'd seen how people live, and so he made a very bold and charismatic innovations of his own that completely reversed many of the Maoist policies in the next 10 years. Instead of politics in command and class struggle in command, economics was now in command. He saw the major contradictions that China was too far behind economically and that that's where the focus should be. And instead of ideology dominating, pragmatic rationality should be the dominant consideration. Rationalization of production, people given responsibility for economically rational ways to do things. So in many ways, he turned Mao on its head. He still believed in the communist, in a communist ideal, and he still saw himself as a communist. But he was much more pragmatic, and his basic principles were start from the bottom, give greater so in that way, he was similar to Maoism. He believed that he should be more decentralized, give more responsibility to the lower levels. Start with the simple and go to the more complex. Start with the easy parts of society and reform those first. That was the agricultural sector. So he started with the, he didn't have a big bang like the Russians did after their collapse of communism. He started with the more simple sectors and worked on one step at a time, incremental reform, and start with practice and then work up to more ideological principles. So it was moving from step to stone to stone in the stream and so forth. And by the end of, after a decade, there had been major, of course, economic transformation. It was a choppy cycle. You had booms and busts, but the average economic growth rate was around 10% during the first 10 years. I think probably what caused the crisis, of course, the Tiananmen crisis in 1989, what the major factor there was the unresolved controversy about political reform. Deng himself periodically encouraged political reform, talked about political reform, didn't give very clear notions about what he meant by it, but he would encourage people and there would be ferment and controversy about it. And that's what started in Tiananmen in the spring of 1989, culminating in this huge demonstration, the huge, biggest since the Cultural Revolution, that was crushed with armed force, of course, and with somewhere around 800 people killed or something. So that marked the end of the Deng Xiaoping period and another period of ferment and pause and controversy when there was consideration of reversing the reforms and so forth. A lot of ideas being bubbling around, not an open debate, but under the surface among the elites. This was finally resolved in 1992 with Deng Xiaoping's voyage to the South, his Nanshun, in which he declared his support for reform again, reaffirmed his support for reform. This was economic reform only. Political reform was out of bounds for the next period. And so the period after 1992, I call it deepening reform, a different type of reform. More centralized reform, to have a stronger central control of reform so it wouldn't become so chaotic. But continued marketization. Marketization continued with greater central leadership, and opening to the outside world was profoundly, was a profound aspect of this reform. In 1984, China's external trade was about 6% of that of Japan's with the United States. By 1996, it was 78% of Japan's. By 2004, it was 250% of Japan's. So this huge mushrooming of trade really took off in the 1990s with opening up of China. China entered the WTO in 2001, made significant concessions, more than most other countries had to make to get into the WTO. They reduced their tariffs by about down to about 5% average tariff rate. So they've been they've taken basically a trade sort of export oriented growth strategy to their development since that time, in which exports become the foundation for technological modernization of their own economy. And this has been not original, not entirely original. Taiwan, the small tigers, Hong Kong, Singapore, South Korea have also taken this strategy. But the Chinese have been unusually open. Unlike Japan, for example, they've been open to outside investment. They're largest since 2003. They're the largest source of foreign direct investment in the world, distancing the United States. So they present a dilemma to people who become concerned about the loss about the imbalance of trade because they're quite open to imports and so forth. So that brings us up to today. Whether this, we've seen this cycle of about 10 years, I'm running out of time, 10 years per stage, where we may be due for another sort of, it depends on whether they face a crisis. If they face a crisis, then there may be a sort of rethinking. They're encountering pushback on their world trade policy from various trading partners because of imbalance of trade and imbalance of payments and so forth. So currently there is a world financial meltdown of which they are perhaps better equipped to deal with this, with about $2 trillion foreign exchange surplus. But nevertheless, they're starting to hurt, and there is a lot of unemployment in the South. There are a lot of businesses, small businesses have been going bankrupt in the South. So their economy is suffering, and it may turn out to be a crisis that may precipitate another rethinking of their growth strategy. So thank you. I'll stop there.
I'm sure there are many questions, and I'm sure that most of them have to do with the present and the immediate future. So while you're organizing your thoughts, let me ask one about the linkage between the two papers, okay? And that would be the notion that Joe suggested of wu-wai, of there's nothing on the outside, and the linkage between domestic and foreign policy. Do you see that as similar in the PRC period to the traditional period, or having any special characteristics? It seems like you're describing a phase shift that's where the domestic politics is in the driver's seat and foreign policy follows. But is there a sense in which there is significant differences between internal and external policy in China?
Of course, I'd like to hear Professor Escherich's views on this too, but that was one of the striking things that I read his paper, is that wu-wai notion. And the slogan I've heard in the PR, with regard to the PRC is ne wai yo bie. I mean, there was an internal and external, there's a difference.
Yeah.
And making that a sharp difference, actually.
And coexistence between different systems too,
right? Yeah. And difference, yeah. You have to have a tolerance for segmentation,
yeah.
Departmentalization. Yeah. So what goes here doesn't necessarily. We can have internal tightening and out external. And in fact, that's been a policy since the 90s. External, yeah. External opening, internal tightening.
Yeah. So very interesting. Joe, do you want to add something to that?
I think I agree very much with what Lowell said, and also having gone through the whole period of isolation during the Cold War, when there was a very clear distinction between what was internal and what was external, I think the distinction between internal and external has become much clearer under the PRC. But the problem, in a sense, persists on two levels. One, you know, I would suggest, as I did, that still domestic legitimacy depends very much on the successful handling of foreign relations. So that connection, I think, still very much maintains. But the other problem is that in the new global world that we live in, the distinction between domestic and foreign is everywhere becoming much more difficult to draw. And in the Chinese case, there are at least two clear instances where the boundaries are very, very muddy. And their perception and perceptions outside the rest of the world are very, very different. One is Taiwan, which as far as they're concerned is an integral part of China. But in the perception of many people in Taiwan, it is a separate country, a separate nation, and it is a separate political entity, and much of the rest of the world has a separate, not formal diplomatic relations, but at least relations with Taiwan. And if China were to treat Taiwan as a purely domestic problem and go and invade it, I think that would be regarded as an international crisis. So is that domestic or is that? And the other is Tibet. In very much the same way. And I gather there's going to be a talk later today in which the question of is Tibet part of China will, I'm sure, be part of the agenda. As far as China is concerned, it is. As far as the Tibetans are concerned, it is not. And once again, the world is divided on that. So these areas are in an interconnected world, increasingly fuzzy.
So the sticky fingers of globalization reach into contemporary politics. I should mention that Lodi Gyari, who is the Dalai Lama's chief negotiator with China, is giving a talk at UVA this afternoon from 5 to 6, I think, in Campbell Hall. And the talk is on Tibet and China, past, present, and future. So this is a very busy day. I truly appreciate people being here. Now, I'll open the floor for questions, and I'd last ask for people to identify themselves before asking their questions. And so, yes? There's a microphone that's coming.
Thanks. My name is John Peel. Mr. Dittmer, in your fine paper on China Rise, which I read yesterday, you discuss hegemony. In your talks, you made some comments about China is not imperialistic over alien cultures. I do not believe that China, I believe that China takes very seriously protecting the in territorial integrity around its borders from Tibet to Xinjiang to Hong Kong to Macau and Taiwan and all around. But I do not believe they're interested in control of other territories. Yet you talk about a Chinese hegemony, and you use the Chinese phrase ba dao, and I don't quite understand what that means. Could you discuss this whole issue, please?
Answers to the end.
Why don't you take that one?
Why don't you take this one?
All right.
Because this is a pretty specific question.
Yeah. Ba Dao is opposed to Wang Dao, the princely way as opposed to the way of the bandit. And so we have our notions of hegemony in the Western culture. For example, Gramsci made various very important contributions to the idea of hegemony. And it's more neutral, it's more morally neutral. But the Chinese conception of hegemony is morally loaded. In other words, it's a bad thing to practice the way of the bandit. And so no Chinese leadership would admit to aspiring to hegemonic position. Zhou Enlai said, we will never be hegemonous even after we develop. And Deng Xiaoping has repeated that. And it makes them more ambivalent about the idea of China rising, because they're not equivalent. Rising to a position of power and prestige is not hegemonic. It's a moral sort of an injunction. So that means that they should not bully people if they become powerful.
Yeah. Very good. Given the Miller Center's golden rule about finishing programs within an hour, I think what we'll do next is collect several questions and then allow our speakers to return.
Brad. Yeah, Brad, the Department of History at UVA.
Historians have loud voices, so perhaps.
The concept of Ba that you just noted wasn't always the way of the bandit. The Ba, the hegemon, can be acceptable in times when there is no morally legitimate leader, as during the Warring States. But when there is a morally legitimate leader, Confucianism, and even more so Neo-Confucianism after the Song Dynasty, is a totalizing philosophy in the sense that there can only be one system of belief. Pluralism is not part of the game here. Hierarchy is integral to the social structure, the political structure, the structure of relations between countries. There can be no objection to that. I would argue the same thing is true domestically with the Communist Party and socialism. There is only one correct way of thought. Some have interpreted and argued about what that is, but pluralism has again not been part of the equation. China, however, since the era of Deng Xiaoping, has entered more and more into a global set of relationships in which they are forced almost by a fait accompli to deal with other nations as equals. That's the why, the external. What about the internal? Is it possible to maintain a shared relationship with equals externally, but maintain the position of one with no pluralism internally?
Very interesting. Other questions?
Yes.
You have the microphone.
Other questions? Yes.
What extent, I'm Sandy Houseman with Virginia Public Radio. I wondered if you could comment on the extent to which environmental problems could derail or at least delay China's ascendancy.
Okay. Environment? We're collecting.
I've got one over here.
At least.
Excuse me, I have a question for Mr. Escherich about the tribute system. It seems to be very successful with Vietnam and Korea. And you talk about a rigidity with some flexibility in negotiations in places. But even in like the Song of Odes, there's some contradiction where it says, within the land bordered by the sea. And it seems like China's always had some trouble with the islands, like Japan especially. And during the Zhengho missions, Zhengho Xiaxihai, when they were encountering Java, they seemed to have a lot of troubles there. And it almost seems like the tribute system didn't work in these circumstances, and they turned a blind eye to a lot of it.
Very good. Maybe one more question, then we'll turn it back to our... Wait for your microphone.
I have a couple. For
no, you
Professor
have a name.
Brandon Yoder, I'm a grad student in the political science department, politics department. For Professor Dittmer, you suggest that there are cultural reasons, you imply, at least to me, my listening, that there are cultural reasons for why China is not pursuing any kind of territorial expansion. I was wondering, throughout its entire history, whereas European states have, and it seems to me that there are some obvious structural factors for why European states like Britain might pursue resources and greater populations abroad that China doesn't have because of its large landmass. I was wondering if you could address that. And then for Professor Escherich, I was wondering about if you could say a little bit about what legitimacy is and entertain a counterfactual about, so if a Chinese government, any time through its history, failed to attain legitimacy, how would things differ? Because there are constant uprisings, no matter how well the foreign policy is conducted. There's constant domestic unrest throughout the period you're talking about. So how would it be different? And if legitimacy is just acceptance within the population for cultural or ideational reasons, then how do you distinguish that from coercion, which is obviously going on at the same time?
So. Great questions. So now we're going to have the perfect answers to these questions.
Let you take the first two.
Okay. On the question of there is an interesting split between China's foreign policy and its domestic politics. China now preaches international democracy, and they've criticized Bush for trying to impose Western values on third world countries. And will that be applied to their domestic politics? I think this is where, you know, Ne Wai Yo Bia might apply.
There's differences between inner and outer.
Inner and outer have differences, and what applies externally doesn't really apply domestically. And so far, they've been able to hold that remarkably well. I mean, there have been attempts to introduce democratic ideas. Chinese Democratic Party was introduced into China by some overseas students who brought it back, and they were promptly arrested and so forth. And so there have been. But they have a very tough security apparatus, and they've been able to maintain this, that there's a difference, and so that it just doesn't apply what goes on outside. So it hasn't transferred. On the other question of environmental issues, yes. Environmental issues may slow down their progress if they're forced to do something about it, if they're obliged to sort of correct their environmental problems. And the United States has really had not been a very strong position to sort of push them in this direction, having refused to ratify the Kyoto Convention and so forth. The United States has not been a world leader on environmental questions for the last several decades. And they have not been under strong pressure. But this may change under the Obama administration. Or certainly the Europeans have been pushing for environmental legislation, international environmental legislation. I think it doesn't really slow, it doesn't slow their GDP. Just the environmental degradation itself does not slow their GDP. It just becomes hard to live with.
Relations with people beyond the seas, I would say that, probably the Book of Odes, a quote about Sahajane, about within the four seas, should be understood more metaphorically. I think that was the Chinese conception of the entire world. And it wasn't a distinction between sort of land neighbors and sea neighbors. Nonetheless, I think the point you make is a good one, the Chinese did tend to make a distinction between people beyond the seas, which were much more difficult to control and much more difficult to keep within their system. The Japanese explicitly opted out of it quite early, and the Chinese allowed them to opt out of it. The relations with Southeast Asia, other than Vietnam, which was right on their border, felt it was to their advantage to sort of opt into the system. The others that had to be reached by sea, were much more problematic. And furthermore, during both the Ming and the Qing dynasty, there's this strange disconnect between official policy and reality, in that on the books were laws that prohibited anyone from having a double-masted seagoing vessel. And you were not supposed to be able to trade with those people at all. Whereas, in fact, there was a very vibrant inter-Asian trade. But it becomes a trade that's very difficult for us to document because no official could talk about it because it was officially beyond the pale. So that was another one of these cases in which the official reality of what was going on and what was actually happening on the ground had a tremendous divergence, and it was partly the conflict of reality coming against the Chinese fictions that was what brought about the Opium War and all of the differences with Western imperialism there. As to legitimacy and how do we measure it, I think I'm tempted, to go back to the Chinese proverb that if you succeed, you're a king, and if you fail, you're a bandit. There is unrest, and there are challenges to the system consistently. That is a perpetual, but the system maintains itself through a heavy dose of coercion, but it also has to have a high degree of consent in order to continue to function. At some point, however, it has periodically broken down, and there have been large-scale protests and large-scale rebellions. And what we've tended to say is almost a kind of de facto solution. Well, if the rebellion succeeded, then the king was illegitimate, and the new dynasty becomes the legitimate one, and it calls the shots, and it's recognized. That is, I would note, sort of the way the international order works as well. That if a government gets overthrown and a new government comes in place, it gets rights of succession to all the privileges of past treaties and so on of that country, and we recognize it as legitimate, and that's happened. So if one is to take that to the present Chinese case, one, it's incredibly difficult to make any judgment as to how legitimate the current Chinese regime is. And I think if a foreigner went in and asked, legitimate, probably the answer would be overwhelmingly, yes, we accept this as the legitimate government. Are there a lot of people very angry at the government? Are there a lot of people that have a lot of beefs with the government? Is there a lot of opposition and complaints about corruption? Absolutely no question about that. Does that endanger the fundamental legitimacy of the regime? Probably at the moment, no. But if the thing were to break down completely, I think it's not impossible that the thing could fall apart, something else could arise. And at that point, we'd say it was had reached the end of its legitimacy. It is going to attempt to establish a new legitimate regime. But that line between legitimacy and coercion and consent is always difficult to draw, and it's always a mix of the two that are concerned there, especially in an authoritarian system such as China.
Well, regardless of whether China is reaching any ends, we are reaching the end of our time here. And I would like to call everyone's attention to our next meeting, which will be February 13th, in which we will deal with the question of what did China worry about and what does China worry about, namely security. So I welcome you all back then, and let's thank our speakers for giving an excellent start.